Welcome to the Parley podcast at The Hindu. I'm Suhasini Heather, the diplomatic editor and your host for today. As we discuss India's neighborhood policy, is it being reworked and should it be? With me, India's former foreign secretary, the former special envoy on climate change, as well as the former chairman of the NSA, B. Shyam Saran. He's the author of the book, How India Sees the World, From Kautilya to the 21st Century. And my other guest is Dr. Constantino Xavier, Center for Social and Economic Progress, who earned his doctorate in South Asian Studies. He's the author of many papers on the subject. Mr. Saran, if I could start with you, recent visits in the region by Foreign Secretary Harsh Shringla to Maldives, to Nepal, to Bangladesh and Myanmar, as well as the National Security Advisor's travels, appear to show a re-energization, if you like, of India's neighborhood policy. Over the past 6 years, there have also been strains at various points, with Nepal over the constitution, now over the map, with Bangladesh over the Citizenship Amendment Act. So my question really to start this discussion, is India's policy in need of reworking?
Let me begin by welcoming the fact that there have been several important visits by Foreign Secretary Harsh Shringla to our neighboring countries. Also, you referred to the fact that the Forum for Maritime Security Cooperation amongst the island nations has also been revived. And this is something that needs to be welcomed. My problem is that, sometimes we find that, our neighborhood diplomacy is something which is more episodic in character rather than something which is, part of a process, part of a more continuous engagement with the neighbors. And unless we perhaps carry forward what you see as this flurry of activity, which you say, into a constant and high-level engagement at various levels, at the leadership level, at the bureaucratic level, at the people-to-people level. This has to be something which is part and parcel of a long-term policy of consolidating our relations with the neighborhood, of making certain that, India's interests are, constantly kept in focus by constant dialogue and as I said, engagement with the neighborhood. If a crisis occurs, we become very, very active. Once the crisis, diminishes, then we sort of lose interest. That is not the way in which you can nurture a good neighborhood policy.
Interesting. Dr. Xavier, would you agree? Ambassador Saran makes the case that while these neighborhood forays are welcome, they must not be episodic and only dealing with high-level visits.
Yes, absolutely. The more stability in India's neighborhood policy in terms of continuity and multiple levels of engagement, the better. But four quick points on this, Suhasini. I think number one, there's no single Indian neighborhood policy, right? So we have three competing, sometimes cooperating tracks that overlap, sometimes clash, sometimes are aligned, that explain India's policies towards its neighbors. There's a political track, which you rightly mentioned, with unprecedented outreach from Prime Minister Modi in terms of visits to leaders, phone calls during the pandemic, a clearly high-level political engagement that is very strong. At the second track, you have a security level in terms of, for example, Indian support to Sri Lanka before and during and after the terror attacks in Colombo. So a lot of intelligence, security cooperation, a geostrategic angle, defense approach to the neighborhood. I would say a classical approach to the neighborhood. And then you have what is, I would argue, the most important approach, which is a bureaucratic, economic, diplomatic approach to the neighborhood, which is fleshing out the various connectivity agendas, whether it's greater railway connectivity, road connectivity, development assistance, digital connectivity with its neighbors. That is really what will take India's regional interests forward, rather than the political and security track, which are also important, But I would say the only fundamental approach is really this economic connectivity track that India will have to work very hard on. Second, I think there's constant work in progress, as neighborhood policy is impossible as a task. I think any Indian diplomat that has dealt with the neighborhood will confess that it's impossible to get all ducks in a row. There are very various different countries. Let's not forget that Bangladesh is not a small country with its population. In fact, it's also not a poor country anymore, because in terms of GDP per capita, it's now a wealthier country than India as of this year. Third, I think, you know, if India's policy towards the neighborhood now, over the last 10 to 20 years, in particular over the last 5 years, has been to increase connectivity, interdependence, integration as a form of strategic leverage, I would risk an assessment saying that India is doing more than ever now on that front, but that's still far too little and far too slow, given what is the competition from China and other states. I think that is really the last point I'd like to make, that China has done India a huge favor by coming in into South Asia, by delivering infrastructure financing, by delivering on, you mentioned, scholarships, educational exchanges. All of that Chinese engagement has pushed India to do much more in its neighborhood and abandon the luxury of taking these smaller neighbors as countries that are perpetually aligned with India and therefore taking them for granted, which is no longer sustainable.
All right, so minimize concerns about the big neighbor. Dr. Xavier, the External Affairs Minister Jaishankar speaks of the necessity in the region of generosity with firmness. Do you think that's the way forward? We've seen the government in the past taking a very tough line when it comes to Pakistan, also when it came to Nepal and the constitution and the blockade that followed, or whether it was with cutting visits to the Maldives because of its differences with the former leader there, with Sri Lanka, a very fractious relationship with the Rajapaksas, if you like. Do you think the firmness is necessary for India to take its neighborhood policy forward as much as the generosity?
So generosity obviously is not a new concept. It comes from the 1990s. It comes from the language Ambassador Saran was mentioning about asymmetry, about first mover, about India being willing to go the extra mile, to open its markets, to deliver, to support cooperative initiatives in the region. In fact, I remember Prime Minister Modi speaking in the relationship with Nepal about India being a Sherpa, for example, for Nepal, about being willing to carry Nepal forward, to support Nepal. But I think on the firmness side, absolutely. I mean, that's the traditional language of international politics. But I'd say more than firmness, clarity is needed. And that means setting clear red lines of what India expects from its neighborhood, from its neighboring countries, and what it will see as an hostile move or inimical move. And I think on that, Delhi has some more work to do. It is very easy to accuse any of India's neighboring countries of being too close to China, but it's very difficult to set out the exact terms of what Sri Lanka could, should do with China or not, and that really hurts security interests. So I'm only concerned that sometimes the larger geostrategic reasoning of China as a security threat is used as an excuse to limit Bangladesh's capacity to deepen its relations with China or accept Chinese investment in its own infrastructure modernization. So that leads me back to the point that naturally all these countries in India's neighborhood will try to balance. They will always be anxious about India, which is de facto the giant in this geography. And therefore, you also want to avoid emphasizing cultural proximity, civilizational likeness in your speeches, in your statements, because such language will naturally inflate the concerns and anxieties among the domestic citizens in these neighboring countries that see India as more concern than they see China or any other neighboring country. So the only way to really solve all this is, as I mentioned before, to focus on creating the larger interdependence in this region that will give India strategic leverage. That is one thing, again, we can learn from China. It is Chinese economic engagement with Nepal, Bangladesh, and Sri Lanka that has been that has led China to increase its strategic political leverage over these countries.
In fact, your own studies, Dr. Xavier, have found that China has outpaced India on several parameters in the last few years, whether it is on trade with these South Asian countries, infrastructure, investment, tourism, education. And now we're seeing China's forays in COVID assistance in the neighborhood as well. Is there a way to counter that? Has India just simply been blindsided in this?
No, I think naturally, we live now in a region that is an open competitive market, to use an economic image. That means that all these countries in India's neighborhood used to depend and rely much more on India in the past, but now are adopting a first come, first served policy. They have an open doors policy and they don't care if it is Chinese ventilators or Indian ventilators that are reaching their capitals first to address certain emergencies like during this current pandemic. So that again leads India, as I mentioned, pushes India to do much more, and it has. If you look at the various connectivity initiatives that we have identified that India has taken over the last few years, I mean, in terms of basic energy interdependence, infrastructural connectivity, grants and loans to the neighborhood, the numbers have been going up. And that is not just because India is feeling more generous towards its neighbors. It's because India is in a tight spot facing the competition you rightly mentioned from China.
So it is a reaction in a sense. Mr. Sarang, would you like to weigh in on this idea of whether firmness is necessary along with generosity? You spoke earlier about the push factors, if you like, tough domestic policies in India, like the CAA, like the MAP disputes, leads to reactions in our neighbors. But do we actually need to deal with some amount of firmness?
You know, I think if diplomacy is not a simple game of, you know, either being tough or being generous. I think it is a much more nuanced, much more complex exercise. So yes, I think the bottom line should be that if you have determined what your key interests are, what your vital interests are as far as the region of South Asia is concerned, that those thresholds should not be crossed. And I think, as Constantino pointed out, I think it should be good for us to generally let it be known what our red lines are. Sure. But I think what is perhaps much more important is that if we are looking at, for example, the threat that we perceive from greater Chinese penetration into the region, what is going to be our coping strategy? So obviously, if we try to match China dollar for dollar, or road for road, or project for project, I think we'll be constantly trying to catch up. I think that's, in my view, that's not the right kind of policy to follow. I think what is very important to perhaps sit down and work out is, what really are the strengths that India has? What are the assets that India has in terms of, really sort of, consolidating its, relationship with the neighbors. And for, with different neighbors, these assets may be not exactly the same. But yes, connectivity is certainly a very, very important area. Building up connections with all our neighbors, whether it is through, the building of highways or railways or revival of riverine transportation as it is happening in the Northeast, or building up, for example, a sub-regional energy grid. All these are things that we can do, because what they do is they bring into play what is one of the greatest assets which we have with respect to all our neighbors, and that is proximity.
All right, so let me ask you...
That is something which... Proximity.
Proximity.
So the proximity is something that can really be sort of made into a big leverage precisely by having greater connectivity. But the connectivity that we have invested in terms of, these transportation linkages, this has to be linked together with what I have constantly spoken about, the software of connectivity. There is no point in having a glass top highway connecting India, say, to Bangladesh, but trucks having to stop at the border for hours and hours because the procedures for allowing cargo or people to move is still archaic. So over a number of our border areas, what we find is that even though the physical connectivity is there, because the primacy of our security concerns, in fact, the movement of goods, of peoples, or services across the borders is something which is still not as good as, for example, what we find in Southeast Asia, or what we find, for example, in Europe. So I think we need to address that as well. That connectivity is not merely, the building of roads or railways, but also making certain that we are able to utilize those as real platforms, real economic corridors, allowing the smooth transit of goods and peoples and services. By the way, one of the things that we need to consider is that, we constantly talk about, the importance of transit, for example, through Bangladesh to our northeast. We talk about the importance of transit, for example, through Pakistan to the Gulf or to Central Asia. What many people do not realize is that as far as most of our neighbors are concerned, we are the most important transit country. Mm-hmm. And yet, we do not, offer the kind of services for efficient, transit through India, as could have been possible. Why can't we, for example, give national treatment to our neighbors with respect to the use of our transportation network, or to the use of our ports for their exports and imports? Why limit them to this port or that port, or limit them only to one or two corridors? Let it be open to everyone. In terms of the more competitive environment which we face today in South Asia, what you should be aiming at is, how do you present yourself as the most efficient, as the best possible alternative in terms of the economic development of our neighbors? If you can do that, I think the picture will dramatically change.
Interesting point. In fact, also for India to be an airport hub for the region, that's still an unrealized dream.
Absolutely, sure.
Now, both of you have spoken about the China factor, but we're also seeing increasingly other countries, especially the United States, as it re-pivots to Asia and re-engages with the Indo-Pacific policy, and particularly South Asia. We saw last month a U.S. defense agreement, an initial agreement, really, with the Maldives. The U.S. is pursuing the Millennium Corporation Challenge through South Asia and Nepal and Sri Lanka as well. My question being, should India see the U.S.'s engagement as possibly a counter to China in the South Asian region as a boon or a cause for future concern where India could get cut out? Dr. Xavier, if you could start.
As far as I see India's neighborhood policy, the approach has been that greater partnership through coordination and cooperation with other extra-regional powers except China has been welcome. That includes foremost Japan. The India-Japan discussions and coordination of policies across South Asia have increased tremendously over the last 5 years. It includes also the US, the French, and other Russians also, for example. So I think India's neighborhood policy has been marked by an open doors approach to coordinate policies and reduce redundancies. So in many ways, if you look at what's happening in Nepal, the British have a development cooperation program, the Japanese have theirs, the Americans have theirs, India has its own. And often these countries have been working in parallel without communicating, coordinating. which has only benefited China because it plays a divide and rule approach and has been able to make the most out of it. What has been changing, I think, over the last year is that India has been much more favorable and open to coordinating and aligning policies in South Asia. That has an advantage because it increases synergies between, you know, infrastructure financing, for example, with the Japanese and Sri Lanka, on political issues in the Maldives between the United States and India to deal with various regime changes there and emergency responses and a certain division of labor emerging between Washington and Delhi. But at the same time, of course, it opens up a precedent because often the argument from China is, if you're letting the Americans into the region, we also have the right to establish our own presence and expand on it. So that's a tough line for India to navigate. But certainly, I'd say bottom line, the approach is one of working closer together with the so-called like-minded partners that are fellow democracies that think alike about regimes, developmental priorities in these countries, and also about economic connectivity with the rest of the world.
Mr. Sarin, how would you see the US's engagement here?
You know, I have a slightly different view. You know, I do not have an issue with, you know, since we are not in a position to really match the kind of resources that China is able to deploy in the neighborhood. It does make sense for us to join other partners who are currently benign partners like the United States or with, you know, Japan, as was mentioned. But let me give you the example of the time that I was ambassador in Nepal. It is not that we were not coordinating our activities with the Americans or the British or even other actors. But, you know, it was with the clear understanding that India would be in the lead, that the, you know, we would welcome support, we would welcome coordination from the other powers, but with the clear understanding that it is India which would be in the lead in any such partnership. So in the current phase, my sense is that perhaps that element is getting weakened, where perhaps the United States of America or Japan or some of the other powers may be pursuing projects or activities which may not necessarily be aligned to what India's objectives may be. And that it could be a problem, you know, in the future. So the answer to that dilemma is, yes, let us welcome whatever, you know, support we can get in terms of, you know, making sure that our neighbors have a choice when it comes to undertaking various kinds of, you know, economic activities or infrastructure projects. But in having that kind of a cooperation or coordination with other major countries, I would hope that India's, you know, objectives, India's interests remain as the primary element.
All right, final question I'd like both of you to weigh in on is, we've got through this discussion without mentioning the overarching regional organization that for 35 years really, or 30 years at least, meant South Asia, SAARC, the South Asian Association for Regional Cooperation. Clearly with Pakistan in the chair and India making it clear, India will not, the Prime Minister will not travel to Pakistan to attend the SAARC summit. It would seem that SAARC engagements have been put on hold indefinitely. So my question to both of you, is SAARC dead? And is SAARC necessary at all? Dr. Xavier, would you like to go first?
I would say that more than SAARC, the format of the regional organization that SAARC has adopted is outdated and does not serve any longer the complex, fluid, regional cooperation agenda. So I think India has taken a pragmatic policy, unfortunate policy, like as often has been recognized by the Indian government, but pragmatic in the sense that Pakistan has taken a very different approach to regional connectivity. It is mostly one as a hub between China and the Gulf or Central Asian regions. so towards the west and the north, while India therefore had to respond and seek to gravitate the subcontinent more towards the south, the Indian Ocean region, and the east across the Bay of Bengal with Southeast Asia. So effectively, what we've been witnessing over the last 4 years now is another chapter in the split of the subcontinent between India and Pakistan that therefore has manifested itself in the stagnation of SARC. India's response to overcome that has been at various levels. India has often taken several bilateral shortcuts. It has tried to do bilaterally what it cannot do any longer regionally because it takes longer, it is more complex, and SARC is not available in that sense anymore. It has taken new initiatives like the one Ambassador Saran mentioned, or revived the one, for example, on security with Sri Lanka and the Maldives. It has revived, of course, BIMSTEC and put in a lot of energy in strengthening that institution. It has worked the other quadrilateral, which we don't talk so much about, but it's very important, called the BBIN framework on motor vehicle and water governance between Bhutan, Nepal, India, and Bangladesh. So I think India has taken a customized case-by-case approach to effectively pursue the most important objective, which is increasing connectivity across different functional sectors in the region, and no longer hold its cooperation agenda hostage to a consensus at SARC, which will always depend on a Pakistani veto.
Ambassador Saran, I'll give you the last word. Are BBIN and BIMSTEC really alternatives? And the question, is SARC dead and should it be?
BBIN and BIMSTEC should be pursued for their own merits. I do not see that they can really replace SARC. If we consider, regional integration, eventually to, in fact, cover the whole of South Asia, even if we are having difficulties currently with Pakistan, even if Pakistan's orientation is towards more towards China or towards its western flank, I think the overall objective and the ideal of a fully integrated South Asia is something which we should always keep in front of us. I don't think we should abandon that particular vision because that is important for us. The other point I would like to make is that as far as our other neighbors are concerned, with the perhaps the exception of Bhutan currently, they are interested in SARC. They do see SARC as a worthwhile platform for regional cooperation. Now, if India is going to turn its back on SARC, there could be a possibility, since this has been brought up before, of China being welcomed into SARC. If India walks out, for example, and I think India would walk out if China were brought in. But if that were to happen, our challenges would become even worse. So I think even though SARC at this point of time is not functioning as the best instrument for promoting regional cooperation, I think there are various other reasons, particularly with respect to how the political dynamics in this region is working out, that we should keep that vision alive. I would not be in a hurry to abandon SARC.
All right, don't leave the South Asian dream just yet. Gentlemen, Ambassador Saran, Dr. Xavier, thank you so much for joining us. This has been the Hindus Parley podcast.
Thank you.